Getting to know G.E. Moore was one of the highlights of my early years at Cambridge. Although he was 2 years my junior, I was very quickly attracted by the clarity and passion of his thinking and by a kind of flame-like sincerity which roused in me a very deep admiration. He was, at that time, slim and beautiful, and he had what he retained throughout his life, a quite extraordinarily lovable smile. When I first knew him, he had not yet become interested in philosophy, except to the extent of accepting the doctrines of Lucretius. In a paper which I heard him read at this time, he began, "In the beginning was matter, and matter begat the devil, and the devil begat God." After an epitome of cosmic history, the paper ended, "And then God died, and next the devil died, and matter remained." This simple creed was shattered by the influence of MacTaggart, who, for a time, caused both Moore and me to think well of the philosophy of Hegel. In this philosophy, mind alone is real, and reality consists of thought thinking about thought. This philosophy was supposed to offer a substitute for religion, but at a great expense. One must not permit oneself to believe in the expanses of the sea, or in the sun and moon, or in the great nebula in Orion. All these things were illusion, so we were told, from which mind suffered when it forgot Hegel. Moore, first, and I closely following him, climbed out of this mental prison and found ourselves again at liberty to breathe the free air of a universe restored to reality. Moore had in these early years a quality which, in spite of all his subsequent achievements, he never quite recovered. I asked him once whether he considered me a prig, and he replied, "No, a pedant." I think that in his later years, the accusation of pedantry could be brought against some of his more minute discussions. His first important publication, The Nature of Judgment, published in 1899, retains, to my mind, more of the early quality of intellectual intensity than is to be found in his later writings. I do not mean that what is said in that article is more true than what is said later. I am thinking only of the kind of intellectual passion that it displays. Although there was, to my mind, a loss in this respect, his work retained its other merits to the last. He had always an impeccable intellectual integrity. He sought clarity uncompromisingly, and with none of the concealed bias that makes the work of most philosophers tortuous and, in a sense, dishonest. Except when engaged in philosophical argument, he was remarkable for gentle kindness. When his sons were infants, one used to meet him pushing their pram, and as a father he must have been exceptionally delightful. In argument, however, he was vehement and formidable. I remember an occasion of a public debate between him and C.S. Myers, the psychologist, in which Myers said something that surprised him by its to him incredibility. Moore looked amazed and exclaimed, "Oh!" The whole audience laughed and felt that Myers had been refuted. Moore was the most truthful man that I have ever known, and his obvious integrity was such that his lack of polite evasion gave no offence. Once, when he was staying with the Bob Trevilians, Mrs. Trevilian at lunch said, "I'm afraid the soup is too salt." Moore replied, "Decidedly," but no one's feelings were hurt. I said to him once, "Moore, do you always speak the truth?" "No," he replied. I believe this to be his only lapse from perfect veracity. Although I have told these stories before, I allow myself to repeat them because they are illustrative of his character. It is difficult to convey to those who did not know him his very great charm, which hardly appears in his argumentative writings. In spite of his vehemence in argument, he was quite exceptionally modest. He had a rare kind of simplicity, which, at a later date, I found again in Einstein. It is a kind of simplicity which comes of thinking only about the subject concerned and forgetting completely its relation to one's own ego. There are certain respects in which I think that his philosophical outlook was open to serious criticism, although as to this, many philosophers would disagree with me. I used to say as a joke that Moore's philosophy had one fundamental premise, namely, that everything he was told before the age of six must be true. This appeared both in his devotion to common sense and in his ethical beliefs, particularly as expressed in Principia Ethica. Moore's ethical doctrines were taken up, and I think considerably distorted, by his immediate successors at Cambridge. Keynes wrote an account of what his contemporaries derived from Moore's ethics, and from this account it would seem that they noticed only what he said about intrinsic excellence, and ignored altogether the more utilitarian aspects of his doctrine. They seem also not to have noticed a certain moralistic fierceness, which intrudes surprisingly in some passages of Principia Ethica, though not in his later work. I think that his philosophy suffered from the fact that his education was purely literary. He knew very little science, and apparently did not think that science had any important bearing on philosophy. In the autobiography which he wrote in the volume on himself in the Library of Living Philosophers, he says that while he was at school, most of his time was spent in translating English prose and verse into Latin or Greek, and vice versa. This caused him to attach enormous importance to verbal precision. Undoubtedly, verbal precision is important, but like everything else, it can be overestimated. I do not know how much justice there may be in the above criticisms, but I do know, and of this I feel no doubt, that Moore performed an enormous work of liberation for British philosophy. It is difficult for the present generation to realize what academic philosophy was like when he and I were young. The great figure of the time was F.H. Bradley, who dressed up Hegel in a garb that made him less repellent to British temperaments. But Bradley retained the belief that space and time are unreal, and there is nothing real except spirit. He retained also the doctrine that no truth is quite true, which to me as a mathematician is peculiarly disagreeable. With Moore, British philosophy returned to the kind of work in which it had been preeminent in former centuries. Those who are too young to remember the academic reign of German idealism in English philosophy after T.H. Green can hardly appreciate what Moore achieved in the way of liberation from intellectual fetters. All honor and gratitude are due to him for this achievement.